This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we remind you that no matter where you live in our great country, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are people that have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom, and each week we meet them as we honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want their stories to be preserved so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. Sometimes we're even inspired by the things that we hear. And the first thing I have to say today, I don't know about inspired yet, but I sure am amazed by the length and depth and breadth of the Air Force career of the gentleman we're going to meet today, retired Lieutenant Colonel John Decker. And you live in Merced, is that right, or Atwater?
Merced,
but we're visiting here in Atwater at the beautiful Castle Air Museum. And have you done an inventory of all the planes on the grounds here and counted how many of them you actually flew? Because I think you flew quite a few.
Well, I figured at least, I didn't actually check, but I figured about at least one-third of them I've flown.
Yeah.
Because I started out my career in 1941, and as a result, the Air Force had some airplanes from the 30s plus the new ones.
And the different things that they had you doing in your career gave you access to a lot of these planes that some people have seen, some people have heard about, but you actually experienced from the cockpit. 93 years old. You don't look 93. What's your secret to staying so young?
Having a good-looking wife.
Well, you guys haven't been married that long, though. How long?
Only 72 years.
Only 72 years. Keep working on it. Get back to me. We're going to get the story of how you met and the secret to your success in that part of your life. But let's go back early on. You grew up a New Yorker. Maybe we'll hear a few little latent parts of the New York accent as we get through this interview. What was life like growing up in New York in the 30s?
Well, it went from living out in the island, Long Island, where it was mostly farmland, and then became, after World War One, a community for overflow from Manhattan. Then it became a urban type city. It grew up from looking out at farmland to looking out at housing. And they built quite a few after World War One. Other than that, I went through normal thing of grade school, college. I went to Long Island University.
You're a football player?
I had a football scholarship and played football in the fall and rugby in the spring until one day my father come home with his ad, and it said, showed a picture of a man with a helmet, goggles, leather jacket, and a parachute on his butt. And it says, you too can become an Army aviation cadet and earn between $120 and $140 a month.
And how much money was that? Because, I mean, here you'd live through the Depression. I imagine that sounds like a pretty good fortune there.
Well, yes, but when you say it now, it doesn't seem very much. And the thing is, I couldn't figure out why one second lieutenant was worth $120 and another one $140. And finally explained it to me, $140 was for a married officer. Uh-huh. So when my wife came down to my girlfriend came down to put on my wings and everything else, and my father says, I'm leaving her here. I figured, I'm going to get the $140.
Sure, that's not the only reason you proposed. Tell me how you and Ruth met.
Well, I use the thing that's not quite true, but she had two sisters, total of three girls in the house, and her middle sister was a blonde, and I just somehow met her, and some of you remember the phrase that blondes have more fun. So I asked her to go to movies with me. She says, fine.
This is the sister.
That's the sister. Uh-huh. And I got to the house and knocked on the door, and she came to the door, Ruth. And she says, what do you want? I said, I got a date with your sister. And she looked at me and she says, you're too old for my sister. So I said, what are you doing? So we went to the movies.
And who knew at that moment that you'd have 72 years together, huh? Is that a little hard to believe in retrospect?
Well, my wife has a saying she has for all the people she runs into. What is what?
Let's get this from Ruth. Go ahead.
Don't get old. Find something else to do.
And that works for you?
Yes, it does.
Well, and tell me, in that moment, when he came to the door. What possessed you to say what you said? And did he just give us the true story there?
Pretty much, yes. He was too old for my sister. But she, like he said, she was a blonde, blue-eyed blonde, and everybody hit on her first. But I was her older sister, so I intercepted.
And did you have any inkling that when you said those things that you'd be stuck with this guy all these years later?
No, not the slightest inkling. I had all kinds of other plans, and grow up in New York and go to work in New York and get married in New York eventually, but that was way down the road.
So you get married. This is 1941. You're already a cadet. You're in the service. Where were you when Pearl Harbor happened? What do you remember about that?
Oh, I was laying in bed on Sunday, December 7th, waiting to be graduated on December 12th, and I heard this radio broadcast and the president, and I said, uh-oh, here we go. And sure enough, we did. I left for England 3 months later and was the first combat outfit in England. And we were there before the end of the Battle of Britain. And as a result, we then got on a ship to go down to Northwest Africa and evade Africa.
And I want to hear about all that, but just so I understand the timeline, when exactly did you get married? Was that right after Pearl Harbor or a few months?
5 days after Pearl Harbor, she came from New York with my father and pinned on my wings. And then my father said, I'm leaving her here. So I figured I was obligated to do something. So I graduated at 12 and I got married at 4. As only a second lieutenant bachelor for 4 hours.
So 4 hours passed before you got that promotion and that $20 raise, huh?
Right.
And you mentioned going to England. You know, most guys that I talked to, even those that were in the service, it still took a while before their training was complete and they got where they were going. But you guys went over there really early. And you're a pretty young guy at the time. What was going through your mind as you headed across the Atlantic and prepared for unforeseen circumstances? Do you remember what that felt like, leaving a young wife behind and not knowing what your future held?
Well, yes, and not only that, we had to go by ship, and it was the largest ship convoy at the time, and they had submarine warfare going on, and we got south of Greenland and entered deep fog, and we could hear the other ships going woo, woo, and then all of a sudden it lifted 3 days later. And there were no other ships in there except us. And we were a little concerned about, are we going to make it to England? But we made it. We made Northern Ireland first, and then we got to Southern England and debarked.
I know you guys hadn't been married very long, but was it difficult to say goodbye to Ruth? Did you have any great words of wisdom, or was that an emotional moment for you? What was that like?
Well, I quickly learned that in the service, you have to do what they tell you to do. And so when we went from graduation, we got orders to report to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and it said, without delay. And no one explained to me that in the service that means 500 miles a day. I didn't even have a car. So a friend of mine going up to Connecticut said, why don't you ride with us? And we rode without delay. Didn't stop except for meals and stuff like that. And at midnight, we arrived in Fort Dix. And I debarked and got a taxi cab and went out there, and they put me up at guest quarters next day. And this was just before Christmas. And next day, the personnel officer said, we don't have what your orders read here, Fort Dix Air Defense Base. So what are your plans? So I said, well, we live out on Long Island and right alongside New Jersey. He says, well, go home for Christmas and come back later. So we did.
I bet that was a very memorable Christmas.
It was. And then I left her there, and I took off. And that's the last time I saw her until I came back 2 years later.
Well, let me come back to Ruth for just a minute here, because I'm sure all the ladies in the audience are putting themselves in your shoes and wondering what that must have felt like. Here, you just married this guy, and now he's going halfway around the world and putting his life in danger. What was that like for you?
Well, it was kind of worrisome, but everybody else in the area was doing the same thing. All my friends were either getting married or their husbands were going overseas someplace.
Did you have doubt whether he'd be back? Was there part of you that feared he wouldn't?
No, I don't think so. I knew he was competent and he had a good airplane, and no. And everybody else was doing the same thing at that time, too.
And what did you do while he was over there?
Oh, I ran into a boy I'd gone to school with, and he said, "Ruth, they're hiring women out at Grumman Aircraft on Long Island. Go out and see if they'll take you." So I went all dressed up like you go to work in New York City, and they were hiring women, but he said, "We won't hire you in a dress. Go home and get a pair of coveralls and come on back." So I worked at Grumman Aircraft, first working on a heat treat tester, because metal has to be heated, and the machine goes through a machine. And then they put me over in Plant 4, which was flight operations, because they wanted somebody small enough to fit behind the pilot and install the automatic pilot. So that's what I did.
Well, that's kind of not every World War II pilot has a wife who's working on aircraft. And I suppose you probably would have trusted any aircraft that she worked on.
Yeah, well, actually, when she started flying in the airplane, installing an automatic pilot, she ended up with more flying time than I had.
Yeah, I don't know if everybody caught that there, but Ruth would actually go up in these airplanes, TBF Avenger torpedo bombers like the ones that made their mark at Midway, and she was small enough that she could climb in and install the autopilot, but that had to take place while the plane was in the air. So she did have you beat in flight time for a while, but I know that didn't last long. You mentioned getting over to England and that you were part of the first combat outfit there, your bomb squadron, the first American unit to bomb targets in Europe during World War II. You had to use British planes until your A-20s arrived. And here you are, 21-year-old kid, getting your first taste of war up close and personal. What did you experience over there in England?
Well, our first arrival at an airport there was an RAF base. We heard Lord Hehor in Germany, who was propaganda, and he was announcing the fact that the 15th Light Bomb Squadron has arrived at Kettering RAF base. And if you'd look out, and he said, "It's too bad, too, because you're not going to last very long. And if you go out in the front and look at the gate, one of the hinges is off." You know, this is, huh? So we had an intelligence briefing on you can't write to anybody and say where you are or anything else, but you can send a telegram to your wife. So I sent a telegram and say, "Arrive safely," period. Couldn't say anything else. And the next thing I found out later on was that it was a RCA message, and at the top it says Kettering. So my wife calls RCA and says, "Where's Kettering?" And they said, "Oh, we have two, one in England and one in Australia." Well, she knew I didn't have time to get to Australia, so she knew exactly where I was.
Pays to have a smart wife. She can read between the lines a little bit. And so at this time, with that 15th Squadron, propaganda notwithstanding, you knew what you guys were dealing with. And you were flying an A-20, the Havoc?
That's correct, yes. And it was, of course, it was designed for ground support and wasn't really suited for flights out of England to Europe, because it only had about a four-hour range on it. So we were finally shipped on the invasion of Africa and to a different unit that we got down at, had A-20s that flew in from the States, and we did submarine patrol in the Mediterranean.
And I want to hear about that, but it's time for our first break. 93-year-old retired Lieutenant Colonel John Decker of Merced, California, our guest today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.